owe them, but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Ben Bueller Garcia. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. If you were to do an internet search for the Battle of Manila, you would find 12 entries dating all the way back to the year 1258. This is one pearl of the Orient that's a jewel over which men have long squabbled. The World War II Battle of Manila began February 3, 1945, and lasted about 30 days, and it featured some of the most bitter street-to-street, house-to-house urban combat in the Pacific Theater. Bitter, it's an apt word that could be used to describe the feelings of both the victors and the defeated when it came to an end. While the shooting began on February 3rd, the stage was set for the two main adversaries, both military leaders of some fame, earlier on. Both were also looking to redeem themselves on the field of battle. For the Americans, General Douglas MacArthur, and on the Japanese side, General Tomoyuki Yamashita. Joining us today to shed a very, very glaring but illuminating light on this major battle of World War II is James M. Scott. James is a very accomplished writer. He has four books about military history, including his most recent Rampage, MacArthur, Yamashita, and the Battle of Manila. Regular listeners might recognize James. He's been an American Warrior Radio guest twice before. What can I tell you? He's a great writer, and I always learn something new from his books. James, if you're with us, welcome back to American Warrior Radio.
Ben, it's so great to be back. Thank you for having me on this Saturday. So pleasure's all mine.
Well, James, I'm a big fan of your work, and actually we've got a couple things in common in addition to our love of World War II history. First is we both, I think, have met Colonel Dick Cole.
Oh, absolutely. I've spent a good bit of time with Dick over the years. You know, he is the last surviving Doolittle Raider. He was also Jimmy Doolittle's co-pilot on that legendary mission over Tokyo in April 1942. And so Dick is, he's 103 and he is still out and about telling the story of the Doolittle Raiders. So pretty amazing individual.
He's a peach. James, if somebody wanted to read maybe the best book ever written about the Doolittle Raid, what would the title of that be?
Well, you know, I'm a little biased. I, of course, have to say it's Target Tokyo, Jimmy Doolittle and the Raid that avenged Pearl Harbor. But then again, I wrote that book.
Well, and I've read all of your books except for one, and Target Tokyo is the one that got me started. I'm a huge fan. Now, the other thing we have in common, we're both appearing at the Tucson Festival of Books coming up March 2nd and 3rd. I'll be moderating a panel called Crime for the Ages. We've got two writers whose novels take place during the Second World War, and then you'll be there talking about Rampage and some of your other books, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I'll be there. Actually, I'm doing three events there. Two on Saturday and one on Sunday, all about Rampage. So it's all going to be military history. But I love the Tucson Book Festival. This will be my second time coming. I think Tucson's an amazing town. This is truly one of the best book festivals in the country. So it's just for me, it's a real treat to get to come back.
And no question, for those of you who can hear the Tucson signal and those of you who are listening in Phoenix, I tell you, it's really worth the drive down the freeway to attend this festival. I agree, it's one of the best in the country. James, let's talk about your new book, Rampage. I just finished it up last week. Let's sort of set the scene. Let's start with the two, what I'll call the main characters. Let's start with General Yamashita, because he's probably lesser known to most of our listeners. I found it intriguing. He fought against the German Empire in World War I, but then sort of went on to become a German expert.
Yeah, and he's definitely one of the more interesting figures in the military establishment in Japan. You know, his big claim to fame really was the victory over the British in Malaysia and Singapore at the beginning of the war. He had really kind of come in there with a force about a third the size of what the British had there. And really outfought them. And by that, I mean, what he did is, you know, the big naval base there at Singapore, which was really sort of the crown jewel of the overseas empire for the British, was really designed to repel an attack that came from the sea. And so what Yamashita did is he exploited that weakness and attacked from the land, and he used the great British infrastructure against them, that they'd had all these wonderful paved highways leading all the way down the Malayan Peninsula. And so in order to be able to move fast, he brought, you know, his 30,000 troops in, and he brought bicycles, because with those bicycles, they could move straight down those highways. They could, if bridges were blown, they could just lift the bicycles on their backs, cross the rivers themselves, and keep moving. And it really was just a pretty ingenious way to do that. And as a result, they were able to cover, you know, hundreds and hundreds of miles in just a matter of a couple short months to suddenly be standing there at the back door of Singapore. And as I mentioned a minute ago, you know, the British were very much expecting any kind of attack to come from the sea. And here you had the Japanese literally at the back door. And so it really was just a pretty clever way to do it. He, of course, you know, defeats the British there, captures Singapore, Malaysia, and it's it's really just a huge blow to the British as well as the Allies at that point. I mean, it comes here in February 1942, literally on the heels of the attack on Pearl Harbor, the loss of Wake and Guam, and you know, the Philippines are under siege, and then here comes Yamashita, and he manages to literally seize the crown jewel of the British overseas empire. Out from underneath them.
Well, I mean, this was huge. If I'm not mistaken, James, this was the largest surrender of British troops in the history of the United Kingdom.
Oh, it was. It was an absolute huge blow to them. And I think actually it was compared at the time to the British surrender at Yorktown during in the battle against the Americans. And so really it was a huge blow to them. You know, the British were already under threat from the Germans in Europe. And, you know, here they were. I mean, Singapore, yeah, they had invested, I mean, just hundreds of millions of dollars in this base. I mean, it was really the back door to India and their overseas possessions there. And then just boom, in a matter of just a few short weeks, it's gone.
One thing I've learned and I've always found fascinating about all of your books, you know, particularly Target Tokyo, was that the amount of research that you do, James, is magnificent. And I never knew about – we know about the politics on the U.S. side, but I'd never given much thought to the politics on the Japanese side, you know, particularly the entry into the war. And so how did the Tiger of Malaya go from being a rising star in the Japanese military to basically the guy got sidelined for most – I mean, he kind of – after Singapore, he sort of disappeared.
Yeah, he really does. And you're right. It gets to the heart of the internal politics. And it's his relationship with Hideki Tojo. And, of course, Tojo is the war minister and prime minister in Japan at that time. And he and Yamashita had a long history together. You know, they'd gone to school together. They had served overseas together. And so they knew one another. And after Singapore, you know, Yamashita's star was really just rising. And Tojo was consolidating his power and whatnot in Tokyo. And he viewed Yamashita as a threat. And he needed to get him out of the way. You know, it was better to have him kind of out of sight, out of mind. So he sent him to, after Singapore, rather than let him come back to Japan, to the mainland islands, sends him up to Manchuria, basically parks him there on the wall to guard against a potential Russian invasion. And it really, of course, there was no real threat of that at that time because Japan and Russia had signed a neutrality pact in April 1941, but it really just got him out of the way. And he spent the whole rest of the war up there until Tojo's ouster. You know, Tojo eventually is fired after the Japanese lose the Mariana Islands, Guam, Saipan, and Tinian in the summer of 1944. And no sooner is Tojo ousted than Yamashita's career is resurrected. And he's brought back to Japan and then sent to the Philippines to stand in the way of Douglas MacArthur.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Douglas MacArthur. Boy, this guy, the weight that he carried on his shoulders, first of all, being the shadow of his father, Arthur MacArthur Jr., Medal of Honor at the Battle of Missionary Ridge during the Civil War, quite a leader in his own right.
Oh, absolutely. We could take up your entire program talking about Douglas MacArthur.
Okay. Really, well, someday we will.
And his father even, because they really are. I mean, I think one of the fascinating things. A lot of folks may not realize this, but you're right. You know, you mentioned his father going all the way back to the Civil War. His father was a Medal of Honor recipient there during the Missionary Ridge. These father and son literally span, if you think about it, from the Civil War all the way to the Korean War in American history. So you think about that. They're you know, the Civil War, the Spanish-American War, World War I, World War II, Korea, and these sort of father and son. And of course, they also both have very strong ties to the Philippines as well, which is, you know, sort of at the heart of Rampage. And the MacArthurs are without a doubt, I mean, sort of that military aristocracy of American history, for good and bad. I mean, they both had their moments of greatness and their moments of of not so much greatness. So so they really are a very fascinating father-son duo.
Now Douglas MacArthur, probably one of the most remembered quotes of the Second World War, his famous quote, "I shall return," in reference to the Philippines. And you sort of touched on this, James. The Battle of Manila was personal for MacArthur, wasn't it?
It really was. And that's what I think is so important about this story is that, you know, so many people think, they lose sight of the fact, particularly now that we're 74 years after the battle, that the Philippines was an American colony. And it's really important for people to remember that at that time, on the eve of World War II, there was huge connectivity between the United States and the Philippines. We had, not only did we have thousands of American troops there in the Philippines, but we'd spent 40 years since we captured the Philippines during the Spanish-American War, really building Manila in our image. I mean, we'd sent Daniel Burnham over there, who was this famous municipal planner and architect. I mean, he helped with the redo of the National Mall. He's the one who came up with Lakeshore Drive in Chicago, the Flatiron Building in New York. And so he had sort of outlined this plan for how Manila should develop after the Spanish-American War. And during those 4 decades, from the Spanish-American War up until World War II, it had really blossomed into this real American city in Asia. And it was called the Pearl of the Orient. And it was filled with neoclassical buildings. It was filled with American service members, but also thousands and thousands of American civilians. And these were the overseas executives and employees of companies like Westinghouse, Studebaker, General Electric. And so there was this great symbiotic relationship on the eve of World War II between the Philippines and the United States. Douglas MacArthur was a big part of that. You know, his father had helped capture Manila during the Spanish-American War, served as an early military governor there in the islands. Douglas had actually, his first assignment after he graduated from West Point in 1903 was to the Philippines. He'd come back multiple times after that in positions of greater authority and responsibility, all the way up until 1935, when after he finishes being the chief of the staff for the United States Army, he comes back over to the Philippines and accepts an invitation to help build a modern army for the Philippines, which was planning for independence in 1946. And so he then takes up residence in 1935 there atop the Manila Hotel, which is still there today, a very luxurious hotel, where he lived with his wife and his son was born and lived there with him. And so for MacArthur, you know, those years leading up to World War II, I mean, Manila was his home. And, you know, he was the son of a career military officer. You know, his father had, growing up, you know, he was born on a military base in Little Rock. He'd spent his childhood bouncing around the West as his father was in the Army, and time in Washington, time overseas. You know, for this young Douglas who had really spent his life pinballing around America and the world, Manila was like a hometown for him.
Okay.
He had these great personal connections to the city.
James, we're going to have to take a breather here real quick. I like I said, I respect you for your amount of research. I mean, today I've already learned that it's Yamashita. Not Yamashita,
yeah.
Right? Got that one, number one. Number two, when we come back, I'd like to get your opinion on something based on your research, if you can answer this question for us when we come back from the break. And that's whether or not you believe that MacArthur would have left the Philippines if he'd not been directly ordered to do so. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by one of my favorite military authors ever, James M. Scott. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined on the line by James M. Scott, one of the best military writers I know. You can find out more at jamesmscott2t's.com. James, before we move on, I left you with a quiz before the break, but Tom, the man behind the curtain here running things, wanted to remind me that, and I don't know if you touched on this in Target Tokyo, but the goblets, the Doolittle Raider goblets, those famous silver goblets that were part of the probably one of the more interesting traditions in the military. Those were donated by the citizens of Tucson.
1959. That's one of the great stories of the Doolittle Raid, actually. In that 1959, the business community in Tucson came together to present the Doolittle Raiders with 80 silver goblets. And each goblet was inscribed twice with each Raider's name, once upside down and once right side up. And the idea being that when each Raider passed, that goblet could be turned upside down and the name could still be read. And so, and then what is, and then that was sort of brought into the whole Doolittle Raider tradition and ceremony, in that Jimmy Doolittle donated a bottle of 1896 cognac to the Raiders, with the idea being that the last two surviving Raiders would then open up that bottle. And 1896, of course, the year Jimmy Doolittle was born, pour a drink, and then toast all their fallen comrades before them. And so I had the privilege, actually, and the honor to attend the very last Raider toast that was held. It was after Dave Thatcher, who was the second to last Raider, had passed, that Dick Cole actually was the last surviving Raider. Mm-hmm. And so we were up at the Air Force Museum, at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, in a little private conference room there. And that's where the goblets are kept up there. They brought all of them up there, and they're in a really pretty wooden case. I think Dick actually built the case as well. Brought them up there, and they brought the bottle of cognac out, and they poured that, Dick, that last glass. And then Dick raised that glass, and they had a roll call of all the Raiders' names. And after every single name was spoken, Dick said, "Here, here, here." And then when they got to the very end, Dick toasted and drank from his goblet. So it's a really powerful tradition, a really powerful ceremony, one that has literally has its origins in Tucson and has stretched all the way up until just a couple of years ago.
Well, and I tell you, James, when you and I get together at the Festival of Books next weekend, I've got my own Doolittle Raiders cognac story I want to share with you. But that's we're talking about Manila. Let's get back to Manila. The question for you was, do you think that General MacArthur would have left the Philippines had he not been ordered specifically to do so?
That's a tough question. You know, he said all along that he was prepared to stay and die there, and I don't doubt that. I think the bigger question was what would happen to his wife and son who were with him. And you know, his wife, Jean MacArthur, was there, and of course his 4-year-old son, Arthur, as well. And he was committed. He said all along that he was committed and that his wife was committed to die with him. And so, but you would have hoped had he been left that he would have sent them out as noncombatants. Okay. So, but again, he was ordered out. So really in the end, it was a decision he didn't have to make.
James, I got to tell you, like I said, I enjoy your books quite a bit. I have to confess that reading Rampage was a hard read. It was difficult because of the subject matter. Let's sort of frame the context now of this battle. How, as far as square miles, how big is Manila? How much space, battle space, are we talking about here?
Yeah, Manila at that time was about 14 square miles, and on the eve of the war, there are a little over 600,000 residents there. The Japanese occupation of the Philippines those 3 years had produced such an economic meltdown that by the time the battle actually began, the population had swelled to about 1 million people inside the city limits because people had come there looking for work, anything they could do to survive, if you will. So it was a pretty bustling city at that point. But the battlefield was actually a really small, tight area. I mean, most of the stuff in the battle was really fought over just several districts, Ermita, Malate. Of course, the neighborhoods right above the Pasig River as well. So it's a really tight area. In fact, I was just in Manila last week and doing a series of lectures over there. And so I went through a whole lot of these areas. And a lot of the battle sites that are mentioned in the book, I was just there last week, so visiting them again. But it's a tight area. It's a pretty small area.
James, the thing I don't like to talk about, but we have to talk about because so much of it is the heart of this book and really was the heart of this battle, the number of atrocities that were committed, both intentionally and perhaps unintentionally during this battle. One of the things I found interesting was that when you describe the persons on the Japanese side, it wasn't all strictly Army and Marines. There was sort of this cobbled together group of some sailors and some other guys they just found around Manila.
Yeah, they shanghaied some guys off gunboats, things like that, to sort of put this force together.
And I guess the heart of one of my questions is, when I talk about this, is, you know, coming back to General Yamashita, his plan was not to have sort of a last-ditch defense of Manila, but I guess the question for me to you is, do you think that because he had, to some extent, sort of a part of the troops there were sort of a motley crew, that contributed to the breakdown of humanity and maybe led to some of the atrocities there? Because these weren't hardcore disciplined Marines or Army, or is that?
No, I don't think that. And, okay. And I'll tell you why. And I think that's an argument that I think people, like the Japanese, have tried to say, well, you know, we had Koreans there and things like that. I mean, there's no truth to that, actually. I mean, these were actually all Japanese troops. And there's no doubt that they weren't all a cohesive unit, that they had sort of brought guys in from, you know, gunboats and things like that that had been sort of stranded in Manila. But at the end of the day, you have to remember, I mean, these atrocities were ordered, and we have those orders. And the in fact, all the records that were found on the battlefield were translated and are available to researchers. And so this was not sort of a last-ditch, you know, orgy of violence. I mean, this was a planned and methodical effort to eradicate the population. And we know that because the orders spell out how to do it, you know, and they say things like, for instance, when civilians are to be killed in order to save ammunition, group them together in buildings that are scheduled to be burned and burn them or throw them in the river. I mean, so there was thought placed into how to go about doing this. And yet Yamashita had argued that after the battle that, you know, this was really a rogue commander in Manila that had ordered this. And there was, he's right in that there was no direct there was not an order from Yamashita to his commander, Iwabuchi in Manila, specifying exactly how to do this. But you have to remember, his final orders to Iwabuchi were to do everything in your power to slow down the Americans. And if you can hold them up even by half a day, he told him, you've been successful. And, you know, the total destruction of the city and the killings of about an estimated 100,000 civilians accomplished that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it slowed the Americans down by 29 days, an entire month is what it took to finally for us to finally secure the city. And go ahead.
Well, he's an interesting character, too. Iwabuchi, Rear Admiral Sanji Iwabuchi? Because he was going into this fight looking for a fight, and he did not plan to survive it.
He did not. No, and he'd been a failed sea captain earlier in the war. He had his ship shot out from under him off of Guadalcanal, and he'd survived, which in Japanese culture was a big disgrace. And he'd spent much of the war kind of on the sidelines, a lot like Yamashita, until the deaths of so many other more capable seafaring officers had led to his career resurrection, and he was sent to the Philippines. And he kind of saw in Manila an opportunity to redeem himself by creating an urban bloodletting similar to Stalingrad. And his battle orders, as you noted, there was no plan to escape. I mean, these troops were hunkered down. They were going to fight to the death, and the Americans were going to have to, in order to win this battle, essentially have to kill them all. The other thing I'll add, too, is that, you know, this is a unique battle in that it is a battle born entirely on the backs of the civilian population. Mm-hmm. You know, you had 100,000 civilians killed. You literally had 100 civilians for every one U.S. soldier. You had 100 civilians for every one Japanese soldier. So here you had these two outside armies, and the highest casualty rates were among the men, women, and children of the Philippines. And that's why I think this battle has so resonated today inside the Philippines. And I think, you know, for American audiences, and, you know, it's a struggle to read about the atrocities and whatnot, but you go into the Philippines and, you know, you can't tell enough about them because it had such a direct effect on those people.
Historian William Manchester wrote that the devastation of Manila was one of the greatest tragedies of World War II. When we come back, we'll talk more with James. James is just one of the hundreds of authors you can meet at the Tucson Festival of Books March 2nd and 3rd at the University of Arizona. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're speaking with James M. Scott. He's one of the best military authors I know. You can find out more about him, jamesmscott.com. Also, you can meet him at the Tucson Festival of Books coming up March 2nd through 3rd at the University of Arizona. If you can hear my voice, you can get to this festival. It's one of the best in the country. You can find out more at tucsonfestivalofbooks.org. James, coming back to your book, Rampage, I mean, too many atrocities to count, really.
Mm-hmm.
But I tell you, one of the things in your book, I took some snippets of light from a very, very bleak picture. And mm-hmm. that was when you're talking about the internees at the University of Santo Tomas and mm-hmm. some of the things that they did just to keep life going, the camp newspaper, the schools. I mean, you could get everything from a haircut and a shave to, you know, your uniform mended and this little community that they formed there in under some of the worst circumstances. Tell us a little bit about those folks. Who was there and what was their life like?
Absolutely. These were, Santo Tomas is a big school, essentially, in Manila. It's the University of Santo Tomas. And what it was, the Japanese turned it into one of the largest internment camps in all of Asia. And these were the American civilians who had worked for Ford and had worked for Studebaker and General Electric, who, when the war broke out, they were trapped there. And because you got to remember, unlike today, you just couldn't jump on a plane and fly back to the States. I mean, everything was by steamership and things like that. And so when the war broke out and the Japanese so swiftly invaded the Philippines, these thousands of Americans and their families, this was, you know, husbands, wives, children, were all trapped there. And so the Japanese rounded them all up and put them inside this school. And this was not an overnight school. This was a day school. And so you literally had, at one point, the school had about 4,200 people there. By the time it was liberated, there were just shy of 3,700 there. But, you know, as you noted, there was everybody there from, you know, accountants, lawyers to carpenters, even golf pros. And so they hustled to convert the school into a thriving small city. And it was only 50 acres. And you have to remember, it was a prison. They were held there against their will. They had no choice but to stay there. And so these 3,700, mostly Americans, converted this school into a small functioning city. They had department heads that handled things like sanitation and finances. You know, they had their own police service and a jail. They had schools for the 500 children that were there, libraries. They had a boxing instructor and baseball leagues. And so they, yeah, because here they were literally forced to, you know, for over 3 years, be prisoners and sort of sit out this war. And so they had to occupy themselves. And so at the beginning of the war, you know, is in early on up until about the middle of the war, as sort of conditions weren't terrible, they all survived. You know, children got their education, they managed to grow food, things like that. It was in the latter part of the war, when conditions in the Philippines really deteriorated, the economy collapsed, that you saw massive starvation and people beginning to die. You saw malnutrition, diseases associated with it like beriberi. And then it became this real struggle for these civilians just to survive. And so it is. It's one of those amazing stories that a lot of people don't know. And these are American civilians caught behind enemy lines overseas.
And that's why, even though it was hard to read, I encourage people to get your book and read it, because it's just – that is something we haven't – I mean, you see it a little bit in the media or, you know, popular movies and stuff. But, man, it was so awful. But the things they did to survive, and, you know, you talked about – I think they had cut out photos of steaks. And they'd put them up on the wall, and they'd sort of get through from day to day by trading recipes and dreaming about food that they used to eat or things. Now, one of the sort of bizarre aspects of this, James, when I was reading your book, was when the U.S. troops, I mean, they made a mad dash for Santo Tomas, and they liberated that internment camp. But at the same time, you had this sort of bizarre situation going on where some of the internees had a front row seat to a continuing battle for the final holdout. I think it was the education building there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I'll say one thing I'll add, I think, just to kind of touch on what you mentioned a minute ago, is, you know, by the time that the Americans did arrive at Santo Tomas, I mean, the internees were so desperate that they were literally, they'd eaten pigeons, dogs, cats, even rats. In fact, rats were selling for about 8 pesos each on the camp's black market. So it gives you a real window into how starving. I mean, imagine being so hungry that you would eat a rat. Now, then imagine being so hungry that you would pay money to eat that rat. So I think, you know, that gives you a sense of just how desperate these times really were.
Or even more heartbreaking to me as an animal lover, there was a quote you had in there where the family basically gave up their treasured pet cat. The time had come, and so they turned the cat over to the cooks, and you know, Fluffy was dinner.
That's exactly. And I think it was Whiskers.
Whiskers. Okay. Well, yeah. And I'm trying to not trying to make light of it, but yeah, that's just how how bad it was.
Child.
What I read another quote. This was from earlier in his life, and the gentleman said Arthur MacArthur, Douglas MacArthur's father, was the most flamboyantly egotistical man I'd ever seen until I met his son. MacArthur was planning a parade. He had declared the battle over before it even began. Did he, among his successes. Did MacArthur suffer from reading his own press clippings a little too much?
Yeah, you know, he really misjudged what was going to happen in Manila. And he was convinced that the Japanese would evacuate the city just as he had done at the start of the war. And he was so convinced of this fact that he ordered his headquarters staff to begin planning this liberation parade. And they were picking the individual jeep assignments for his senior officers. They were designing the parade routes to get back in front of his old home atop of the Manila Hotel. And his generals were a lot more leery. In fact, they were the intelligence coming out of Manila was a real mixed bag. but by right before they got there, the intelligence was really pointed at the fortification of the city. And they were alarmed by that. But MacArthur really discredited their opinions and sort of went with his gut instinct. And he was wrong. And he did. He actually declared Manila fallen and liberated before the battle even began. And like Newsweek magazine, in fact, wrote right after he made that announcement that Manila fell to MacArthur like a ripened plum. when the reality was the battle hadn't even started.
Yeah.
The battle that would start would end up being one of the most vicious urban and the only urban battle of the entire Pacific War. So not only did he misjudge it, but the battle that followed became truly a landmark battle in the Pacific campaign.
And the Japanese converted every street corner, every house, every road into a fortification. I mean, they even applied what we now refer to as improvised explosive devices.
They did. They booby-trapped dead bodies. They booby-trapped dead animals. They literally went into cemeteries, for instance, and dug fortifications inside cemeteries. They seized the big concrete and buildings in the Philippines that were designed to withstand earthquakes and typhoons, and they made each one of these individual fortresses. You know, they dug wells in the basements of them. They buried food there. They dug tunnels that went out to sort of and trenches that went out to sort of outside pillboxes. And they barricaded the insides of them. They actually, inside these passageways, they built staggered walls out of wood and dirt so that the Americans were, you know, if you came inside these buildings, you sort of had to weave between these partitions to try to get there. And so for the American troops, you got to remember, MacArthur's guys, they were used to fighting on beaches. You know, they'd come from New Guinea where they were storming beaches and fighting in jungles and whatnot. And suddenly they find themselves in this urban landscape, you know, battle block by block, house by house, even room by room. And so there's this huge learning curve for the American soldiers as well. And the Japanese have the home court advantage. You know, they've been there, they've fortified it, they've sort of made mazes through these buildings. So it ended up being, you know, a really bloody urban fight.
And somewhat of a tactical, I don't want to say Achilles heel, but a practical fact of this was we had tremendous air power available to us.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming some offshore bombardment. But because of the nature, I mean, urban warfare, and you have all these civilians there, that was not something that we really, really wanted to use.
No. In fact, MacArthur, a lot of his frontline generals really, you know, advocated we need air power, we need air power. And he refused because of all the civilians. He didn't want to bring unnecessary death to the civilians. Now, and he originally barred artillery as well. After the Americans suffered heavy casualties crossing the Pasig River, he relented and allowed artillery. And at that point, I mean, the Americans fired, I think, 42,000 artillery rounds into the city, which brought in a whole different level of destruction. Mm-hmm. The Japanese were going literally block by block, burning houses and sort of, you know, sending incendiary squads and things like that to destroy neighborhoods and whatnot. And then the Americans were then sending in the artillery at the big buildings, you know, and a lot of these were the big buildings that we had built, you know, the legislature and the finance building, the agricultural building. So, I mean, the city was being destroyed from the inside and the out between the Americans and the Japanese. And then you have all these civilians sort of caught in between it. And that's one of the great tragedies is that the Japanese as well, they recognize the advantage of fighting a war in which you could hide amongst civilians. You know, you had, for instance, the Philippine General Hospital where you had 7,000 refugees there, you know, that were all looking for shelter. And then the Japanese were there with them and they were firing artillery from there and they were using, you know, this hospital as cover. And so, which of course is only going to draw more American fire, create more casualties, and create greater tragedy. And so that's one of the things that made this battle such a mess, if you will.
And you know, just to give folks now you got to buy the book and read it. But one of the more bizarre things I didn't know is, you know, one of the more furious battles was over a baseball stadium, and literally,
I think
the tanks blew a hole in the side of the stadium, and for a little while, what we had home plate and the Japanese had the outfield.
You know, I think we had, they had home plate. We had the outfield. So, because we did, we came in through, through one of the outside walls, you know, and literally as we closed in on them, the battle then moved into the dugouts and the locker rooms. And so the, and the Americans, and that happened a lot. I mean, the, you know, going into these basements and then underground. And that's where the Americans really then fell back on the use of the flamethrower.
Mm-hmm.
The flamethrower was a very powerful tool in a battle like Manila. However, the American troops realized that when you went into these tight spaces, you know, flamethrower will suck up all the oxygen in the room. So, and it ricochets. And so you have to be really careful in how you use it. We also use lots of satchel charges and in order to blow up basements. And then we use bulldozers just to seal them up. As well, another really fascinating story too is Rizal Mall, which is at the University of the Philippines right there in downtown. In fact, it's still there today. I was there last week. I made a point to go by and visit it. You know, here's this education building. The Japanese are literally fighting over it for two straight days, and by the end of that second day, as the sun's beginning to set, the Americans and the Japanese are both up on the second floor of this building, and that, this building is a total wreck at this point. It's been blasted by artillery. I mean, there's rubble everywhere, but neither the Americans nor the Japanese would give up this building. And so that night, the sun sets, and the Americans are literally on one side, the Japanese are on the other, and the Americans are sitting there, the cavalrymen. You know, their fingers are on the triggers of their rifles, and they're listening, and they can hear the Japanese start singing on the opposite side of the building. And they're sitting there listening to them, and as the Japanese are singing, suddenly it's followed by explosions and then silence. And then about a half hour later, the Japanese begin to sing again, and it's followed by more detonations. And this pattern goes on until about 4 a.m., at which time this lasting silence finally settles over the building. Next morning at daybreak, the sun starts coming up, the Americans move in and discover that 77 Japanese Marines had blown themselves up while they listened to them the night before. So, I mean, it's really just that crazy, intimate, urban battle.
James, when we come back, I want to talk about what I found the favorite part of my favorite part of your book was probably the shortest, discussing what happened after the end of the war and what happened to some of these war criminals. But as a reminder, I just want to say, give a shout out to Herschel Woody Williams. Herschel, on this day, for his actions on this day 74 years ago, was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor. He was a flamethrower operator on Iwo Jima. God bless you, Herschel. He's the last surviving Medal of Honor winner from the Pacific out there, still doing a good thing. Folks, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We'll be right back with more with James M. Scott. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with James M. Scott. You can find out more on his terrific books, jamesmscott.com. That's Scott with two T's. We'll both also be appearing at the Tucson Festival of Books, tucsonfestivalofbooks.org. Let me correct that. James will be appearing. I'll just be moderating. big difference. You've earned it. James, one of the more fascinating things I found in your book was maybe the shortest chapter, and talked about what happened afterwards. Before we get into that, something else crossed my mind, and I'm curious about your opinion. The battle for Manila ended early March?
Yep.
Okay.
March 3rd.
Yeah. On March 10th, 1945, the U.S. conducted a massive firebombing raid of Tokyo, probably one of the deadliest conventional air raids of the war. In any of your research, did you get a sense at all of the potential that once we started to discover just these huge number of atrocities the Japanese had committed in Manila, if that might have led to someone in Washington saying, no, pull out all the stops. Let's give them a taste of their own medicine.
Well, Ben, it's so funny you mentioned that. That's actually the subject of the book I'm working on now, right, that you just mentioned. So, in fact, stay tuned. I'll hopefully have that book turned in next year, and then maybe we can get together on your show again and talk about it.
Well, I can check off the question, what's your next project? We covered that.
Yeah, that truly is one of the most fascinating raids, and it is the single most destructive raid of World War II. 104,000 people died that night. 16 square miles of Tokyo were burned up. In fact, there's actually a line in Rampage from General Bonner Fellers, who's one of MacArthur's top aides, in which he said after seeing Manila, quote, if anything should happen to Tokyo, they deserve it.
Mm.
Now, the reality is that that mission and the B-29 raids on Tokyo had actually begun all the way back in the fall of 1944. And so so that was the whole air raids on Tokyo and whatnot were the whole – that whole operation had been really put in place beforehand. There's no doubt, however, that the Battle of Manila caused great pause and consideration among a lot of America's top generals. In fact, Oscar Griswold, who was one of the frontline commanders in the Battle of Manila, wrote in his diary that, and I'm paraphrasing, but is this what we're going to have to face if we have to take Singapore back and Hong Kong and Tokyo? So there's no doubt that if 17,000 Japanese troops could create the 613 square blocks flattened, 100,000 civilians killed, imagine what hundreds of thousands of Japanese troops and civilians, millions even, could do to the American forces there. So the air war, there was no doubt there was tremendous pressure on the air commanders to bring about an end to the war with Japan through the use of air power to prevent us from having to send in the infantry and the cavalry, city by city through Japan to do that. And so that's actually, Curtis LeMay was the commander there and Guam at the time. Of course, Hap Arnold was his boss. He was head of the Army Air Force. They were putting tremendous pressure. In fact, LeMay had just come in January right before the Battle of Manila and replaced Haywood Hansel because Hansel wasn't delivering the results needed. And LeMay and his raid on March 10th was a whole new strategy. Up until that point, the Americans were flying in at 30,000 feet, doing precision pinpoint bombing of steel mills and munitions factories. That raid, however, LeMay throws out the whole playbook. He drops his bombers down to 5,000-6,000 feet, swaps out, demolition bombs for incendiaries, and sets Tokyo on fire.
James, we're kind of running low on time here. I want to talk a little bit about General Yamashita's trial. I mean, that was... I don't know if the word honor comes to mind, but at the end, he really retreated back to sort of his Zen Buddhist samurai warrior code. The job nobody wanted to be the defense counsel for this war criminal, but they actually made a pretty good fight of it, didn't they?
They did, actually. He was put on trial. It's the first war crimes trial in all of Asia, and Yamashita's accused of failing to control his troops. And he's put on trial in what is now the U.S. Embassy. In fact, the ballroom where he was tried is still there. I visited it last week in the embassy there. And so he's tried, and there's no direct evidence tying him. There's no direct order from him to Iwabuchi saying kill all the civilians. But the prosecution made a circumstantial case that it was so widespread and so rampant that Yamashita should have known. And or he's being held responsible for failing to have known what was going on there. You're right. They did. They put up a very spirited defense for him. He was ultimately convicted. His case was appealed all the way to the United States Supreme Court. And there he ultimately lost as a result of that. And then he was hanged in February 1946 in a sugarcane field about 40 miles south of Manila. But the precedent from that case, the idea that a commander could be held responsible for the actions of his troops, still sticks with us today. In fact, John McManus, who's a wonderful historian and author of many, many books, in fact, was emailing me earlier just a couple months ago saying that he was at the Naval Academy this past year. That's one of the things he was teaching the midshipmen. This, because of this case, you can be held responsible. Yamashita, it's interesting. He really blamed everything on Iwabuchi. And there's a kind of a glaring hole there. In that there were the Americans ultimately tallied about 27 major atrocities inside Manila. Manila, that really did fall under Iwabuchi there more directly. But there were about 300 atrocities island-wide, and Yamashita was responsible for all the Philippines. So that's, blaming it all on Yamashita doesn't explain away the other two.
And I want to clarify, when you're using those numbers, you're talking about incidences of atrocities, not individual atrocities. I mean, the individual atrocities were far, far higher.
Oh, yeah, these are just the ones we know about.
Yeah. I mean, mass graves.
This was the effort just to pinpoint what we could.
One of the things that really stuck with me at the end of your book, in 1953, the Philippine president pardoned many of the war criminals, and he said, I'm doing this because I do not want my children and my people to inherit from me the hate for the people who might yet be our friends. James, you got about a minute and a half.
Yeah.
What else do you want to share with our listeners?
Yeah, no, and I think that's a really valid point. I think the President Quirino, who you just mentioned, it's important to note that his wife and three of his children were killed in the Battle of Manila. And yet, despite his own personal losses, he felt it important. He felt it really was up to – if anybody was in a position to try to move Philippine-Japanese relations beyond the war, it would have to be him because he was a survivor of all of that. And so as a result of that, in fact, the Philippines and Japan, I mean, they're I think the largest trading partners right now. So, I mean, it really it did play an economic role after the war and whatnot going forward with those close relationships. So, any other questions that you've got for me, Ben? I mean, I go on and on.
That's why you're such a great guest. I got to say, one of my favorite quotes, I'll close with this one of my favorite quotes from an author. He said, nonfiction books are like historical scavenger hunts. And I'm guessing you know who said that because it was James N. Scott. Folks, you can meet James and hundreds of other authors at the Tucson Festival of Books March 2nd and 3rd on the University of Arizona campus. Most of the events there are free of charge. One of the best book festivals in the nation. They've got events for kids, for families, if you like fiction, nonfiction. And, of course, I'll be spending a lot of time in the history tent with James M. Scott. Again, his website, jamesmscott.com. James, thank you for your time. Ladies and gentlemen, you can hear this and other interviews at AmericanWarriorRadio.com on Facebook, American Warrior Radio. We've even got an Instagram page, amwarriorradio.com. Check out Patreon, patreon.com, American Warrior Radio, if you'd like to help out our mission of expanding these important messages. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com.